For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
For those who are new here, I'm Taigen Dan Leighton, the teacher at Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, and welcome. I'm very, very happy to have as our guest teacher this morning Ruth Ozeki, who is a Zen priest ordained by Norman Fisher, who's spoken here a little while ago. Ruth is, in addition to being a Zen priest, an award-winning filmmaker and novelist, and has written, amongst other books, this extraordinary novel, A Tale for the Time Being, which has in the middle of it a Zazen instruction and discussion of Dogen and time being, and is an extraordinary novel about Japanese Zen and war and peace and being a teenager and being an American and a Japanese and a Japanese-American and just many things. And so I'm very, very happy to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you, everyone, for having me here. It's wonderful. And thank you for showing up on a beautiful Sunday morning. My goodness, what are you all doing here? You should be outside running around and enjoying this strange temperature, this strange warmth that we are experiencing now. It's hard to enjoy it fully, knowing where it comes from, but we should enjoy it anyway, I think. But thank you for coming, and it's wonderful. It's wonderful to be here. I'm always interested in this little ritual of introduction, and to hear what, to hear who I am. It's always a little confusing. But thank you for reminding me, because when we sit in silence, when we sit in Zazen in silence, all of that, sort of drops away, right? And we don't have all of these words that are labeling us, we're just sitting here, and there's this wonderful silence, and we're all sort of held by it, and all of that sort of distinction, drops away. And then as soon as we open our mouths, right, suddenly, I'm the one who's sitting here yammering on for the next 20 minutes or so, and the separation sort of exists again, right? And then, two, I've always struggled with this idea of who, of self. Self is something that's very perplexing to me, so to hear, so I'm a filmmaker and a novelist and a priest, and I'm sitting here, and so what am I right now? Am I a novelist in priest's clothing? And is that, what is that? Is that like a sheep in wolf's clothing? It feels that way sometimes. I feel sometimes a little bit, as a novelist, I feel sometimes a little bit, and this is really odd, I feel a little bit too dangerous to be in a zendo. I feel that I'm going to be disruptive, because part of my job as a novelist is to disrupt. That's what we do. We disrupt, the status quo, and we make things strange. That's part of our job as a novelist. So here I am, a wolf in sheep's clothing. But that's okay, because I see that I'm surrounded by other wolves. So it's fine. We're all wolves in sheep's clothing. So this is very comforting. So today, with luck, let's see. We'll see what happens here. Yeah, there we go. Let's see. What I thought I could do is to talk a little bit about A Tale for Time Being and where this came from, This is a book. Okay. This is a book. We call it a book. And it's a novel, too. It's not only a book, but it's also a novel. And we refer to it generally in the singular, right? Even though we know perfectly well that it exists in an array. You know, there are many hundreds of thousands of copies of this book now traveling around the world on the great gyres of commerce. And it's been translated into 35 languages, so it exists in multiple different languages as well. So those are clearly not this, right? That those are something else, and this is this. And then, too, you know, even if we're talking about this book, it is certainly not something that exists in the singular, right? It's as soon as it's read, right? I do my job. I write the book and I send it out into the world, and you read it, and or maybe you've read it, but you know, when you do read it, then you create your version of this book, right? And so in a way, the job of a novelist is to create this kind of conversation, right? And so I write my version of this and send it out into the world, and then you meet me, right? The readers meet me and read the book and co-create this fictional world that we both refer to as A Tale for the Time Being. But I have absolutely no idea what you're talking about when you talk about A Tale for the Time Being. You know, I assume it's something similar to what I wrote, but probably not. You know, probably it's completely different. And this is a wonderful thing because, I've spoken at length with Tygen about this book, and I can see very clearly that he has created a book that is far better than the one that I wrote. You know, it's far more profound, and it's far more, it's far more wise. And so thank you for that. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity.
Yeah, but there you go. Right. Exactly. Exactly. So this is a wonderful thing, and what's also wonderful about it is that one has no control. You know, as a novelist, I have no control. I mean, I think I have control as I'm writing. You know, I spend all of this time sort of moving commas around, you know, just to try to make sure that you interpret this sentence exactly as I mean it, right? But in fact, that's a foolish and a foolhardy, attempt. It doesn't work. It simply doesn't work. So this is a wonderful thing, and I appreciate that, and I'm very grateful to readers, obviously, because, well, first of all, it's my livelihood, but also because it's this wonderful act of co-creation, and in a way, I think it's a kind of a manifestation of what we call dependent co-arising, right? It's almost a practice of exactly that. And I think all art is, of course, right? All art is exactly that. And so that's a very lovely thing that we do. So I want to be mindful of time because I can sit here and yammer on forever. But what time should we? We have to, since the book is about time, I have to be careful about time. Okay, good. What time are we sort of? You told me this, but I've forgotten. Yeah. Okay, good. Okay, so I just wanted to talk a little bit about A Tale for the Time Being, and I'm just curious, but how many people have read it? Okay, so some people in the room have read it. Okay, so I'll be a little bit more explicit. So the book was largely inspired by a fascicle of Dogen Zenji. And Dogen Zenji was a 13th century Zen priest and practitioner who was also the founder of Soto Zen lineage. Now, this is probably, you're all familiar with this. He wrote a fascicle, which is a very, very wonderful fascicle called Uji. Okay, and I think that probably many of you are familiar with Uji as well. But if you're not familiar with Uji, let me tell you a little bit about Uji. It was written in 1240, and it's an interesting word. The word Uji can mean different things. The character U, right? The Chinese character U, which can also be pronounced Yu, okay, is a character meaning existence or being, okay, and the character Ji is the Chinese character for time. Okay, so if you translated uji directly, it would be being time. Okay, or existence time, or something like that. But it's very interesting because, you know, there's a kind of an instability in this character. So if you write the two Chinese characters, uji, on a piece of paper and show it to a Japanese person, they would look at it and they would think perhaps it was pronounced yuji. Okay, because because of the way that the Chinese language was brought over in the 5th century and sort of superimposed on the Japanese native language. Japan didn't have a writing system, right? And so the Chinese character system was sort of superimposed onto Japanese in this very kind of slippery and awkward way, right? And so as a result, that, you know, if you see a Chinese character, there can be many ways of pronouncing it in Japanese. So in this case, uji is one way, yuji is another. And then if you pronounce it in, you know, Japanese, in the native Japanese, it would be arutoki. Completely different, right? And so the meaning of this is, can be very different. If you pronounce it arutoki, it means something like once upon a time. And so fairy tales often start with this idea of arutoki, right? Mukashi arutoki something or other, right? I can't remember. Yeah, yeah. So a long time ago, once upon a time, a long time ago. When Dogen wrote this, he used these characters uji, right, or yuji, and this has been translated into English in many different ways. It's been translated into English as sometimes as being time, sometimes as time being, sometimes as some moments, some time, and I've even seen it translated as the theory of time. Okay, so this is it's been translated in many, many ways. And I was reading a translation, which I'm sure you're familiar with, by Kaz Tanahashi in Moon in a Dewdrop. And he translates it as the time being, okay? And he uses the hyphen there, okay? And he also uses the definite article, the, all right? And the fascicle, as Kaz translates it, starts with a poem, and I'm going to read the poem to you. It starts with, an ancient Buddha said, for the time being, stand on top of the highest mountain. For the time being, proceed along the bottom of the deepest ocean. For the time being, 3 heads and 8 arms. For the time being, an 8 or 16 foot body. For the time being, a staff or whisk. For the time being, a pillar or lantern. For the time being, the sons of Zhang and Li. For the time being, the earth and sky. So it's a very beautiful poem that is very expansive and trying to, you know, convey a sense of what this might be, right? And when I read it, I kept reading this for the time being, for the time being. And of course you can read it as for now, right? For now, for temporarily, you know, stand on top of the highest moment. For temporarily, for now, proceed along the bottom of the ocean, right? But for some reason, I kept inflecting it differently in my head, right, when I was reading it. And I kept reading it as for the time being. Okay, for the time being, as though there was a being, an entity called the time being, right? And so for the time being, all of these things are happening, right? And so I had this kind of image in my mind of this time being, right? This entity made out of time, who is a little bit like a time lord from Doctor Who or something. And so for this time being, all of these wonderful things were happening. And so there was this kind of slippery, unsettled quality to the phrase in English as it sort of drifted over into English that sort of lodged in my mind and sort of stayed there, and it sort of bothered me from time to time. I would kind of wiggle it like a loose tooth, right? And it just kind of stuck with me, and I think it stuck with me precisely because of that sense of instability that the phrase sort of refused to resolve and become one thing. So in other words, its identity was shifting, and these kinds of phrases are very interesting to me as a writer, and I think I probably started reading uji in the early 2000s, and in 2006 the voice of this phrase sort of came back to me in the voice of a young girl. Okay, and she was a young Japanese schoolgirl and living in Tokyo. And I thought I would just read a very little bit of, and this is the beginning of the story. Okay, now this is the part of the morning where instead of being Zen students, you can relax and you can become 7-year-old children again. Okay, because I'm going to read to you. So just you can relax. Okay. And have fun. Okay, good. There we go. Thank you. We can all go back to being Zen students again. So. We're going to hold these identities. We're going to hold these selves very, very lightly here. Okay. So this is the voice that that came to me in 2006, more or less. Hi. My name is Nao, and I'm a time being. Do you know what a time being is? Well, if you give me a moment, I will tell you. A time being is someone who lives in time, and that means you and me and every one of us who is or was or ever will be. As for me, right now, I'm sitting in a French maid cafe in Akiba Electricity Town, listening to a sad chanson that's playing sometime in your past, which is also my present, writing this and wondering about you. Somewhere in my future. And if you're reading this, then maybe by now you're wondering about me too. You wonder about me. I wonder about you. Who are you? And what are you doing? Are you in a New York subway car hanging from a strap or soaking in your hot tub in Sunnyvale? Are you sunbathing in a sandy beach in Phuket or having your toenails buffed in Abu Dhabi? Are you a male or a female? Or somewhere in between? Is your girlfriend cooking you a yummy dinner, or are you eating cold Chinese noodles from a box? Are you curled up with your back turned coldly towards your snoring wife, or are you eagerly waiting for your beautiful lover to finish his bath so you can make passionate love to him? Do you have a cat, and is she sitting on your lap? Does her forehead smell like cedar trees and fresh, sweet air? Actually, it doesn't matter very much, because by the time you read this, everything will be different, and you will be nowhere in particular, flipping idly through the pages of this book, which happens to be the diary of my last days on Earth, wondering if you should keep on reading. And if you decide not to read anymore, hey, no problem, because you're not the one I was waiting for anyway. But if you do decide to read on, then guess what? You're my kind of time being. And together, we'll make magic. Okay. So this was more or less the sort of voice that came to me in 2006, and I think it was very much a sort of an expression of, you know, this phrase that I had read in Dogen, and it had just kind of, you know, stuck in the gyre of my imagination, the gyre of my mind, and then sort of came spinning out as the voice of this young girl. So as soon as I heard her voice, I knew certain things about her. And this is, you know, one of the odd things about, you know, about writing is that, you know, this voice comes to you and you're not sure, you don't really know that much, but you do know some things, right? And I knew that she was a young Japanese schoolgirl. She was probably in high school or junior high school. I knew that she was troubled, that she was suicidal, in fact, that she was thinking of ending her life. But she also had this kind of spunkiness and this kind of strong, this strength, this attitude, right? I knew she was writing in English, which was odd because why would a Japanese schoolgirl be writing in English? And I also knew that she was writing to somebody. So this was also very odd because she was writing in a diary, but the diary was addressed to somebody who she was, you know, referring to as you. Okay, so this was interesting to me because most of the time, of course, when we write diaries, we write them for ourselves, right? And so here she is, you know, addressing this diary to somebody. And she had all the confidence of a young writer who just, she would write her words down and cast them out into the world, and she had just perfect confidence that somebody was out there who would pick up her words and read them. Okay, so this was interesting because, and this raised a problem. The problem was that Nao didn't know who her reader was going to be, right? And so, as a result, neither did I. Okay? And so then, as a novelist, it's my job at that point to try to figure this out, Right. And, you know, try to figure out who Now's reader is. And so it took me about 5 years to figure this out. Okay, it took me quite a long time to figure this out. And at the end of 5 years, I discovered, much to my surprise, that Now's reader is a novelist. Okay, a novelist named Ruth. Okay. Who lives on a remote island in British Columbia, you know, like me, who is married to a husband named Oliver, like me, who has a cat, like me. Okay, so this was very surprising to find that Now's reader was this character named Ruth. And I'll just read you a little tiny bit of Ruth's section so that you get a sense of who she is. Okay. A tiny sparkle caught Ruth's eye, a small glint of refracted sunlight angling out from beneath a massive tangle of drying bull kelp which the sea had heaved up onto the sand at full tide. She mistook it for the sheen of a dying jellyfish and almost walked right by it. The beaches were overrun with jellyfish these days, the monstrous red, stinging kind that looked like wounds along the shoreline. But something made her stop. She leaned over and nudged the heap of kelp with the toe of her sneaker and then poked it with a stick. Untangling the whip-like fronds, she dislodged enough to see that what glistened underneath was not a dying sea jelly, but something plastic, a bag. Not surprising, the ocean was full of plastic. She dug a bit more until she could lift the bag up by its corner. It was heavier than she expected, a scarred plastic freezer bag encrusted with barnacles that spread across its surface like a rash. It must have been in the ocean for a long time, she thought. Inside the bag, she could see a hint of something red, someone's garbage, no doubt, tossed overboard or left behind after a picnic or a rave. The sea was always heaving things up and hurling them back, fishing lines, floats, beer cans, plastic toys, tampons, Nike sneakers. A few years earlier, it was severed feet. People were finding them up and down Vancouver Island, washed up on the sand. One had been found on this very beach. No one could explain what had happened to the rest of the bodies. Ruth didn't want to think about what might be rotting inside the bag. She would finish her walk and then pick it up on the way back, take it home, and throw it out. Okay. So this is the character of Ruth, and needless to say, she doesn't throw it out. She takes this bag home and leaves it on the porch where her husband, Oliver, finds it. And I'll skip ahead a little bit here. The two of them, Oliver and Ruth, unpack the bag, and inside the bag they find a Hello Kitty lunchbox. And inside the Hello Kitty lunchbox they find various things like a baggie full of letters and a secret notebook, and then a copy of Marcel Proust's A la recherche du temps perdu, In Search of Lost Time. Okay. And Ruth is startled to see this, you know, copy of A la recherche du temps perdu inside of a Hello Kitty lunchbox, right? And so, obviously, wouldn't you, right? And so she opens it and sees that the inside of the book has been hacked, okay? That, in fact, what she sees is this scrawling purple handwriting, okay, written in gel pen. And I'll just read a little bit more here. Print is predictable and impersonal, conveying information in a mechanical transaction with a reader's eye. Handwriting, by contrast, resists the eye, reveals its meaning slowly, and is as intimate as skin. Ruth stared at the page. The purple words were mostly in English, with some Japanese characters scattered here and there. But her eye wasn't really taking in their meaning as much as a felt sense, murky and emotional, of the writer's presence. The fingers that had gripped the purple gel ink pen must have belonged to a girl, a teenager. Her handwriting, these loopy purple marks impressed onto the page, retained her moods and anxieties, and the moment Ruth laid eyes on the page, she knew without a doubt that the girl's fingertips were pink and moist, and that she had bitten her nails down to the quick. Ruth looked more carefully at the letters. They were round and a little bit sloppy, as now she imagined the girl must be too, but they stood more or less upright and marched gamely across the page at a good clip, not in a hurry, but not dawdling either. Sometimes at the end of the line, they crowded each other a little, like people jostling to get onto an elevator or into a subway car, just as the doors were closing. Ruth's curiosity was piqued. It was clearly a diary of some kind. She examined the cover again. Should she read it? Deliberately now, she turned to the first page, feeling vaguely prurient, like an eavesdropper or a peeping Tom. Novelists spend a lot of time poking their noses into other people's business. Ruth was not unfamiliar with this feeling. "Hi," she read. "My name is Now, and I'm a time being. Do you know what a time being is?" So that's kind of the setup for this book, and the book unfolds as a conversation between this writer Now, right, and this reader Ruth, and so the two characters, and I think this is very much what writers and readers do, speak across time and space to each other and affect each other's lives, right, and so this is very much what writers do. And what I'd like to do is to go back a little bit to the idea of I want to go back to Uji here, and go away. So the before I go back to that, I'll just mention that. It took me about 5 years to figure out that Ruth, in other words, Ruth, as a character, was going to be stepping into this novel and performing as a character in the novel. And this was, it was a long process. At first I thought that it was going to be, I tried out many other characters. It was not something that I particularly wanted to do, to be in my novel. It struck me as being a little bit pretentious and a little bit self-referential and a little bit postmodern in bad ways, and a little bit and very metafictional also in bad ways. And so I really resisted doing this. But I finished a draft. I think I had put four or five other characters in the book to serve as the reader. Some of them were men, some of them were women. The book actually ended up taking place at that point in an urban center, not on a remote island in Desolation Sound. It took place mostly in a library, in fact. I finished this draft in 2010 and was just about to turn it into my editor. And it was not, I have to mention that it was really not a very good draft. It was actually a very bad draft. Everyone agreed that this was not a good, it was not a good draft. But I was about to turn it into my editor, hoping that she would help me figure it out, when in March of 2011, the earthquake hit the northern coast of Japan. And this was one of those catastrophic events that that really changed the world. It really broke the world in certain ways. And I have friends and family in Tokyo and also in Sendai. And so, of course, the first few days were spent just watching those videos, those YouTube videos of that wave. Coming in and just demolishing huge swaths of the Japanese coastline, and it was devastating to watch that. And I'm sure many of you watched that too. I think the world was fixed on that for a good week until something else happened. Right? I think it was tornadoes in Wichita, but which somehow wiped the tsunami off the internet and replaced it with something else terrible happening. But in any case, so I was, eventually able to get in touch with my friends and family, and everyone was okay, and that was terribly reassuring. And but still, at that point, we started getting news about the meltdown at Fukushima. And if you remember, that was also a terrible time, because, of course, at first we didn't get any real information about it. We were seeing the images of the meltdown occurring, and we're hearing all of this, these very, very reassuring words that everything was under control, and in fact it wasn't. And so little by little, the news got worse and worse. And I think we're very accustomed to this, right? We're used to this. This is very much the kind of information. You know, I think of the internet as a kind of a gyre as well. You know, we're connected by these great oceanic gyres. You know, the Pacific Ocean, the Atlantic Ocean, sort of connect the world. But we're also now connected by these great informational gyres of the internet and mass media, and so we were watching all of this devastation sort of spin through this gyre. And at some point along the way, it occurred to me that this book that I had just spent 5 years writing was no longer relevant. Right, the book had been written for a world that didn't exist anymore. Right, worlds are time beings too. Right, and so the world that I had written the book for just it didn't exist anymore, and there was no point really in going forward with it. It was no longer relevant, and so I took the book back at that point. But the voice of this young girl just wouldn't leave me alone. She just kept coming back and insisting on, you know, on being, right? And so I was talking to my husband, Oliver, and if you've read the book, then you know Oliver. But I was talking to Oliver about this, and he pointed out that the earthquake and tsunami and the meltdown at Fukushima had broken the world, and it had certainly broken the fictional world of my novel, right? And so if that was the case, the only way to honor that and to proceed was to acknowledge the brokenness of the world and to allow it to be, right? Allow it to be broken, allow it to stay broken. And the way to allow it to stay broken was for me as a real person, as a writer, as a real person named Ruth, to enter the fictional world, right? And, you know, and be a character, become a kind of semi-fictional character in the world, so that when readers read the book, they would always be questioning, is this real or is this not real, right? So that question, once again, causing a kind of an instability there, an instability of meaning, right? You can never quite settle into one fixed position or another, right? And so this struck me as being a very, very interesting way of proceeding. And it would also allow me to bring the earthquake and tsunami and the meltdown of Fukushima directly into the heart of the book, right? And to write about it and to talk about it directly. And so that's what I ended up doing. I realized that Oliver was right, and I thanked him, as one should always do to one's, you know, for one's husband. And then I pointed out that if I were going to be in the book, then he would need to be in the book too. And so thankfully he agreed. He said that he thought it would be an interesting thought experiment. So that's how we proceeded. And so I wrote the book, and once I started, I basically took the draft that I had, which was about 500 pages or so, and I unzipped it, threw about two-thirds of it away, about 300 pages, and started writing again. And it was very interesting, because at that moment I realized that the time was right, you know, that the time had come to write this book. And I started writing it with Ruth and Oliver in the book as characters, and the whole thing just, you know, flowed in a way that it hadn't before. I'd been struggling before, and suddenly, you know, it was time. It was the right time, and this was interesting to me because, of course, as people, as artists, you know, we are very impatient, and we always, you know, we're always pushing, right, and. This was an enforced exercise in patience, right? And I realized something too, a couple of things. First of all, I always think about patience as perhaps our primary practice here, you know, in the Zendo. Really, what we're doing when we meditate is we're practicing a kind of profound spiritual patience, right? And certainly meditation, Zazen is designed to teach us patience, because it's designed to make us feel very impatient, right? And so when is that bell? When is that bell going to ring? My legs are killing me. My thoughts. Oh, I'm so sleepy, right? So Zazen is really good this way. It's a wonderful tool to make you realize exactly how impatient you are. But it also, it's interesting too, because I realized that as a writer, as a novelist, you know, writing long form fiction, patience, of course, is a virtue, right? But impatience is also a virtue, because, you know, if I weren't impatient to, you know, sort of move forward and find out what's going to happen next, for example, you know, who is Now's reader, what's going to happen to her, you know, what's going to happen to the interaction between them, right? Then I would just, you know, I would just be kind of a laid back person who would be like whatever, you know. And so it's the impatience too. And I really do think it's a kind of a, there's a generative tension that exists between these binary oppositions, these dualistic oppositions, right? This tension that exists between patience and impatience, for example, or, you know, knowing and not knowing, right? And so right now, for example, we're in a state of very uncomfortable not knowing, right? Because of the elections. We really are in a state of a very, very profound not knowing, and it's very uncomfortable. And so at the same time, you know, it's good to recognize that, I think. It's good to recognize that in ourselves. And it's every time I think about the elections, it's just a reminder to sort of take that little backward step and relax into not knowing, right? So in any case, this idea of the importance of patience and impatience was something that I think I learned through the writing of the book. And the other thing I learned, though, was that that novels are time beings too. You know, they take the time they take, and a novel can't emerge into the world until the world is ready, and until the novel is ready, and until the writer is ready. And so all of these factors have to kind of come together in order for the novel to emerge into the world. And it's important, I think, as a writer to continually be, you know, part of my job is to continually be trying, right? In the same way that we are continually coming back to our seat in zazen, right? We're constantly returning to the seat, returning to the page, but, you know, also understanding that, you know, that we are time beings, and that certainly, you know, the artwork, you know, is also time being, and it will take the time it takes. And so just one last thing I want to mention here. I want to go back to Uji and to Dogen. And I just want to read a little tiny bit from Uji, which I think is very beautiful. In Uji, in this essay, the fascicle, The Time Being, Dogen writes, "The way the self arrays itself is the form of the entire world." Okay, I think that's very beautiful. The way the self arrays itself is the form of the entire world. See each thing in this entire world as a moment in time. See each thing in this entire world as a moment of time. The self setting itself out in array sees itself. This is the understanding that the self is time. This is the understanding that the self is time. And you know, this to me is a wonderful expression of time being, right? The way, you know, the sort of the interpenetration between time and being and time, right? And this idea that, you know, we think of ourselves, we experience ourselves as these fixed body personalities, characters, right? Novelist, priest, filmmaker, whatever, right? And but in fact, it's not that simple, right? So this idea of the idea of the self as an array, right, is I think very beautiful. The way the self arrays itself is the form of the entire world, right? See each thing in this entire world as a moment in time, and certainly, you know, as a writer, I'm sitting up here right now. And I'm talking to you as supposedly the writer of this book, right? But in fact, that's a little bit misleading, because the writer of this book is no longer here, right? The writer of this book, you know, stopped being the writer of this book somewhere back in 2012, right? When she was putting the finishing touches on the manuscript, Right? And the person who's sitting up here right now is, I suppose, technically the author of this book. Right? But the author of this book is not the writer of this book. You know, writers write. Authors talk about writing, right? Like, so this is, I am like the PR, I am the PR arm of this array called Ruth Ozeki, right? And so, you know, so these are very, very different things. And you know, it's certainly something that I'm aware of. But it's also, I remember that, I'll go back to this idea of the priest and novelist and also the author and the writer. And, you know, there was a time in my youth when I was very bothered by what I thought of as inauthenticity, right? And so, for example, the idea of sitting up here and being, you know, a priest who's also a novelist was disturbing to me. So there was a kind of a tension there. There was a kind of a, a kind of a tension, right? And this once again, this need to resolve into one identity or another, right, was something that was very important, to, you know, very disturbing to me as a child. And I think it's probably because I grew up as a mixed race. I grew up as a mixed race child, and I never quite knew, you know, whether I was, you know, Japanese or whether I was, you know, white American. I always, as a little kid, I kept thinking that there should be a dotted line somewhere in my body that would divide the halves in some neat way that I could understand. So this notion of authenticity was something that was, that really bothered me as a child. And so it's, I think, through this study of, you know, time being time, right, that has sort of helped me widen out my notion of what it is to be a self, right, and what it is to be, you know, a self that changes, an impermanent self that changes through time, right, and that indeed we aren't, you know, we aren't just one self, right, that we are this entire array of selves that go beyond this physical body, you know, to encompass everyone. And I think that that's, you know, this is really my final point, that that we know this is true. We know this is true because art and literature exist, right? If art and literature, right, if art and literature, if this weren't true, right, if the sense of self did not expand to include everyone, right, art and literature simply wouldn't work, right? It works because we share so much. It works because of dependent co-arising. It works because of, you know, interbeing, what Thich Nhat Hanh calls interbeing, right? And so the fact of art and music and writing and zazen and, you know, and everything that we do in the world, really, it's not just, of course, it's not just limited to the arts, right? But the fact of these things, I think, to me, to my mind, is proof of these very, very, you know, fundamental and profound Buddhist truths. And so this is, so, of course, an understanding at that level, you know, it means that terms like authenticity sort of are no longer relevant, right? So, and that's, I think, what I have to say.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
So we have time. Yeah. We're not going to do a formal temple cleaning as we usually do on Sundays.
Do we have time for questions, or did I blow it? Oh, good. Okay.
Questions, comments. So please feel free.
Yeah.
If you'd like to start.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Like, how is Nao's name spelled?
Yes, it's N-A-O.
Okay.
Yeah, and it is...
It was like a pun.
It is a pun. It is certainly a pun. And once again, it goes back to the slipperiness of language, right? I'm very interested in that, in the way that language... So in Japanese, and I talk about this in the book, there's a concept called kotodama, which is this idea that words have spirits in them, right? They have ghosts or spirits in them, and the ghosts have wills and you know, desires and everything that, you know, that spirits have, and so this is, and I think puns you know, kind of play with that, right? The puns are the playful kotodama, the ones that refuse to settle into one and resolve into one meaning or another, right? They you know, they're bigger, they're wider, they're more playful. And so Nao's name certainly is, you know, a pun. Yeah. Yeah. A pun on the N-A-O-N-O-W. Yeah.
Thank you so much for your talk and for your books. Yesterday I bought a new book of yours called Face. I wonder if you could say a few words about that.
Sure. Thank you. It's called The Face, A Time Code. And I always think of it as time code of a face. And I was asked a few years ago by a Brooklyn publishing company to write an essay about the face, and it was part of a series called The Face. Okay, and so they gave us a quote from Borges, and it was a beautiful quote, and asked us to respond to this and to write an essay of some kind about our face, right? And so I thought this sounded interesting, and the other people who were involved in the project were interesting writers, and I thought, this sounds great. Then, when I actually sat down and thought about what it is that I'd agreed to do, it horrified me, you know. because how am I going to write, you know, whatever it was, 50,000 words about my... You know, about my face. You know, this is a terrible idea. And so then I did what a practitioner does, right? It's like if you're, you know, if I'm feeling kind of so, you know, averse to this idea, I thought, well, then obviously what I need to do is I need to sit down in front of a mirror and spend some time looking at my face. And so what I did, and this is so sacrilegious, but I know there are no Zen police here, it's fine. I have a little altar at home. And I took the Buddha off the altar, and I put a mirror there instead. I mean, and this is okay, right? Because we all have, you know, Buddha nature, right? We all know this, right? So that's fine. You know, when we bow to the Buddha, we are not bowing to a graven image. We're bowing to the Buddha nature in ourselves, right? So that's what we do. So I put a mirror on the altar, and instead of the incense bowl, I put my my computer, and then I timed myself for 3 hours. Right, and I decided I would look at my face for 3 hours and make notes, you know, a time code of all of the observations that arose during that time. And this was based on an essay. This was an idea I got from an essay written by a Harvard art history professor named Jennifer Roberts. And the idea is to teach the value of immersive attention. Right, and she has her students go to a museum, right, and look at a painting or a sculpture for 3 hours and to make notes about their observations, right? And so, well, I mean, my face isn't a work of art, obviously, but I figured it would serve the same purpose, right? And so that's what I did. And I wrote down different observations as I was, you know, looking at my face. These feelings, of course, came up, and I started noticing, you know, the lineage in my face, and I saw my parents, and I saw myself as a young person, and I saw my parents on their deathbed, and, you know, I mean, it was this long, you know, arduous process. And at the end of it, I felt so good after I'd finished. And anyway, I used that as a scaffolding to write other essays, you know, to kind of expand on some of the observations that kind of arose during those 3 hours, right? And this was very interesting, you know, and I finished the book and I sent it off and it was published, and it's just this little thing. And I used I drew a lot on Dogen. I drew a lot on Zen literature about original face, on koans of mirrors, you know. So it was, and once again, you know, sort of thoughts about selfhood, right? And so it's a very Zen, very heavily Zen inflected book. And I sent it off to be published, and then, and you know, of course, it was stupid of me not to know this, but I discovered that there is a long, long tradition in Japanese nunnery, in one Japanese nunnery called Tokeji, of a practice called mirror Zen, right? And Tokeji is a fascinating place. It's a nunnery in Kamakura, and it was started in the 1200s sometime by an aristocratic Rinzai Zen nun, and it was the only place in Japan where a woman could get a legal divorce. And so a woman would have to flee her family and get to Tokeji, and as long as she could throw her shoes over the wall, then she would be brought in, right? And they had armed You know, they had you know, armed samurai there protecting the women, right? And so then she would be brought in, and then she would have to spend 3 years, not 3 hours, 3 years sitting in front of a mirror, sitting zazen, sitting mirror zen. It's called kagami zen, right? And so this was fascinating to me, of course, because I didn't know this when I, you know, when I wrote the piece, but I found out afterwards, and I should have known it because, you know, it had been written about in many of the books about women in Zen. I didn't know. But it was thrilling to find this out. And it's a very radical practice when you think about it, this idea of reclaiming the gaze, right? And sort of owning your image, owning your face, but also, you know, sort of after practicing in front of your image for that long, you do develop a little bit of distance from it as well. You let go of it, right? There's a sort of relaxing of identification there. And I think that was the original intent. So there's some beautiful poems. Yeah, there's some beautiful poems. And, you know, you can go online. Unfortunately, now I feel like I need to write, you know, another volume, you know. But you can go online and Google Tokeji and find out, you know, more about the practice of mirror zen, too. Yeah.
I've enjoyed that book very much.
Yeah, thank you.
It's a wonderful book. Mm-hmm. We will have it for sale along with The Tale of the Time Being in the back afterwards.
Great. Yeah, it was a fun book to write, partly because it was very short. And quick.
It's a wonderful little book.
Yeah, thank you. No, it was really nice. Yeah.
Well, I'm just thinking that I read that book last night.
Oh, good. You see, you can read it in a night, right?
The point that you made just at the end of your talk about the way that everything opens up into everything else.
Yeah.
It's very strongly instantiated in that book.
Yeah.
I mean, just as you know, you start gazing at your face, but it opens up into your life.
That's right.
It's really wonderful.
That's right. That's right.
I'm glad you're a sitter rather than a jumper.
Yeah, I know, right? A sitter rather than a jumper. My father comes from an evangelical Christian lineage that was very much like the Quakers, you know, who quaked, and the Shakers who shook, right? My father was a jumper. So, seriously. On my mother's side of the family, they're Zen practitioners. So I've got the jumpers on one side, and I've got the sitters on the other side. So once again, you know, this tension between the two. So there was something else I wanted to... Oh, that's right. Well, no, I won't even say that. If you're interested, you can read the book. Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Two things. Yeah. One, it was... I actually read this book last week.
Oh, great. Wonderful.
Yeah. Oh, the time's running down. Means to get to this book for
That's right.
And I want to say thank you.
Yeah.
It was very well done, like, integration of literature, fictive reading, and Buddhist thought.
Thank you.
Really, really smoothly done.
Yeah.
Something that the time being who was reading it and the time being now is wondering about.
Yeah.
Was there a decision that you made for why now is written in first person and why Ruth as a character is written in third?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That's nice reading. Ruth is written in the third person, right? And now is written in the first person. And, you know, it was very clear to me that now, and when now started, you know, when I started hearing that voice, it was very clear that that was a first person voice. So there was never a question about that. She could never have been written in the third person because she was, you know, a presence who was so, you know, she was so vivid, and so insistent on being an I, right? Ruth, on the other hand, you know, we negotiated. Right, and so the character Ruth agreed to be written in the third person, partly because it was a very clear way of distinguishing between the first person now, right, and the third person Ruth. So if you had a first person Ruth, then that I would be competing with this I, right, and then that it would be hard for readers to kind of, you know, catch it quickly, right, to make that transition. But also, you know, character Ruth, I think, in a way, you know, in a very Zen kind of way, took a backward step there. And, you know, and she was a, you know, I don't, for some reason, it made sense for her to And probably it has to do with my relationship with her, now that I think about it. Because, you know, obviously I'm the I, right, in this relationship. So she kind of had to be the she. You know, I'm giving her a little bit more agency than perhaps she merits, right? But it was also a way of distancing her from me, right, so that I could kind of tell us apart. And she's different than me, you know, in a way, you know, with all due respect, Ruth, she's not as smart as I am. Right, and she's a very limited version. I mean, for example, you know, in the book, Ruth in the book sold her New York apartment, right, when she moved to Desolation Sound. I didn't, right. So that, to my mind, makes me a lot smarter than her, right. And also, you know, I mean, Ruth in the book, you know, she finds. You know, she found a diary washed up on the shore in British Columbia, in this Hello Kitty lunchbox. You know, obviously, I didn't find an actual Hello Kitty lunchbox, right? But on the other hand, you know, the voice of this girl sort of washed up on the shores of my imagination, right? So metaphorically speaking, there was a parallel there, and I think that was the relationship between, you know, Ruth in the third person and, you know, me, Ruth, the author, in the first person. There's a kind of a metaphorical, you know, parallel relationship there, but it's different too. So that made sense to me, you know, theoretically, to write her in the third person as well. So, yeah. Thank you. Good. Anybody else have any thoughts or questions? Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you. If you could, I hear there's so many storyline. If you can sum up what you were trying to say, what they now are trying to tell her together.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Well, there's a lot. It's true. There's a lot in the book. You know, as Tagen mentioned, there's a significant discussion in the book about war, about World War II in particular. Now is a character who is being bullied very badly in school. So there's a, you know, there's certainly a lot having to do with bullying and power dynamics. She is also, a character who has decided to commit suicide, right, as a result of this bullying. And so she is, the idea is that she is, before she dies, she wants to do one last redeeming, you know, thing with her life. And that is, what she's decided to do is to tell the fascinating life story of her great-grandmother, Old Jiko, who is a Zen Buddhist nun. Okay, she's not just any Zen Buddhist nun. She's an anarchist feminist Zen Buddhist nun. Okay, and now has decided that she's going to tell the fascinating life story of her great grandmother, and before she dies. Okay, and so it becomes a little bit like a. As I was writing it, I was thinking about, well, I was thinking about being a young person myself and being a disturbed, you know, very disturbed and depressed and anxious and angry young person, and thinking about how writing really saved my life, you know, and how, you know, it was really, as long as I could write, I would be okay. I kind of knew that. And that's, I think, what Nao is doing too, that she's, you know, in a way she's writing in order to save her life. And so it was a little bit like a 1001 Arabian Nights, you know, the Scheherazade story, you know, that as long as you can continue. I mean, in Buddhism, we talk a lot about story, right? We talk about, you know, the story, you know, the way we, you know, that we create this sense of self through story, right? And so story is in many ways disparaged in Zen, right? But what's funny is that the Zen, you know, collection of texts is all about stories. You know, there's no other, I think, religious body of text that is as story-filled as Zen, right? So, once again, you know, paradox. It's beautiful. But, so in any case, that was certainly part of it, is, you know, how do you sit with your, you know, how do you sit with your, you know, your suffering, right? How do you sit with your suffering? How do you process your suffering? And so the book is very much about that. You know, the book is very much about this young girl who is trying to come to terms with her suffering. And it's also about the story of this, you know, couple, Ruth and Oliver, on this island, who have their own you know, their own kind of suffering, right? And so I think that's certainly something that, that comes across, you know, fairly strongly in the book. But the key, I think, in a way, the central figure in the book is this Zen nun, Old Jiko, right? And she talks a lot about, well, I mean, she teaches now, right in the center of the book, she teaches now to sit zazen, you know? And so, you know, her, I think her little, you know, her perspective, you know, and the things that she teaches throughout the book, right? She teaches her great-granddaughter, I think probably are the heart of the book. And what's wonderful about it is that, you know, not many of us have, you know, have a great-grandmothers or great-great-grandmothers who are, you know, anarchist, feminist, Japanese, Zen, Buddhist nuns, right? But it doesn't seem to matter because, you know, as I said, the book has been translated into 35, you know, languages, and it's kind of all over the country, all over the world. And everyone recognizes Old Jiko. Everyone knows her. Right. So apparently everyone does have a 104-year-old anarchist feminist Zen Buddhist nun, you know, in their lineage somewhere. Because, you know, it's just instantaneous, the recognition and the love. Right. So that's been fascinating to me. Right. We all have our inner Jiko. We all have our inner Old Jiko. You know, she lives inside of us. It's an archetype that's so strong. And we can trust her. You know, we can trust her and rely on her. So that's been nice. Yeah. Thank you.
So maybe on that note, yeah. We'll end formally, but informally, there'll be more to say. So yeah. Let's close with the four Bodhisattva vows.
Okay.